Today is Tuesday, January 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. House Democrats prepare new articles of impeachment for U.S. President Donald Trump.
She laid out a step-by-step process that the U.S. House is going to be taking this week to condemn President Trump.
So what challenges now face the Republican Party?
Republicans are having to look at this. They're having to investigate who they are and who they want to be.
And officials warn not to get complacent just because the COVID-19 vaccines are out. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump looks to become the first president in the United States history to face second articles of impeachment in a Democrat-led effort to remove him from office. Many Trump supporters disagree, saying the move goes against President-elect Joe Biden's call for unity among a very polarized electorate. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has the details.
Speaker Pelosi laid out in a letter late Sunday night something of the schedule for this week, since events are so unprecedented and they're moving very quickly. She laid out a step-by-step process that the U.S. House is going to be taking this week to condemn President Trump for what they say is inciting an insurrection last week on Capitol Hill with his supporters storming the Capitol. Now, what Pelosi is going to be doing is first she's going to be bringing up a resolution, H.R. 21, that is going to be asking Vice President Pence and a majority of cabinet members to invoke the 25th Amendment, which in short is basically saying that the president is incapacitated and the vice president is going to temporarily take over for him. So basically, Pelosi is saying is that if Pence and the majority of the cabinet do not invoke the 25th Amendment within the next 24 hours, then the House will move forward with a vote on one article of impeachment.
Now, Catherine, I also understand that Speaker Pelosi has brought up something called the 14th Amendment. What can you tell us about that?
Actually, Speaker Pelosi brought that up in her letter to members on Sunday night. She said that many House members had been talking about the 14th Amendment, Section 3, this option of saying that anybody who had incited an insurrection or had somehow behaved disloyal to the United States could be removed from office and kept from ever seeking federal office again. That is definitely an option. And I think that's something that House Democrats might be keeping in their back pocket just because it's not as dramatic as impeachment. They want to respond to these unprecedented events on Capitol Hill in a major way that shows that how deeply they felt what happened last week.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Democrats and some Republicans are calling for President Trump to resign or be removed from office. The demands follow the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol during a joint session of Congress to certify the results of the 2020 election. Now, many people are asking, what are the broader implications for American democracy and the challenges facing a divided Republican Party? Those are the questions that I put to Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert.
You know, the GOP, since the nomination of then candidate Trump, has been going through an identity crisis, trying to understand whether they should coalesce the party or solidify the party around Donald Trump, or if the party was something distinct and that Trump was just an anomaly in the party. So this is something the Republican Party has been dealing with for a long time. And I think that now they're being forced to deal with this. Like, is this the party of Trump and going to continue with Trump rhetoric and Trump policy and Trump politics moving forward? Or is it going to reinvestigate itself and return to some sense of the establishment idea of the Republican Party? So this is something that I think now, where they have refused to have done so in the past, Republicans are having to look at this. They're having to investigate who they are and who they want to be, not just as a political party, but as a voice for Americans moving forward. So they are certainly in an existential identity crisis as of now.
So let's step back and take a look at the broader picture. What does this mean for American democracy moving forward?
Well, for funding, we know that most companies are suspending their fundraising or donations to any PAC that's related to anybody that has anything to do with the insurrection on January 6th or moving forward that might have some ideas of wanting to challenge the certification of the vote. So that's one aspect, is that we know that fundraising, at least for those associated with the Republicans, is going to take a huge hit. Never mind what might happen for marketing or advertising on different platforms, if candidates will be able to even advertise on different platforms moving forward that were associated with this or that voted against certification of the Electoral College. For the broader picture of American democracy moving forward, I can't emphasize enough that the United States has taken a hit. It took its first hit by people saying that there was fraud committed for the election, which, as a political scientist, I'm trying to look at this objectively. And if there was fraud, as a political scientist, I want to be the first to put it out there so that people can understand it and fix it. That has not happened. There's no evidence of it. It doesn't exist. This is politicking for the sake of staying in power and getting reelected. And it goes against the American institutions and the Constitution. It just doesn't make sense. It hurts us moving forward. So that's a serious, you know, America took a hit because of this idea, and that so many people bought into the idea. Because, of course, they're going to believe the president, that the president has information saying that it was more fraudulent than in actuality where it wasn't fraudulent. So that's one point. The second point for the insurrection on January 6th, that's going to be a Pandora's box, because people were assured that nothing like that could ever happen, even from a security personnel standpoint in the United States Capitol. And now that cat is out of the bag. Now it's understood that something can happen. And so there are bad forces in the United States seeking to take advantage of that, and they're already planning that. So this sets a precedent that people that want, that whose elections didn't go their way, that they can use armed insurrection or forced rebellion to get what they want. And that is not the way the American system is supposed to operate. We're supposed to be institutionally understood. And if you don't like the way an election happened, you only have to wait two more years to make some type of change peacefully to go your way. So this is an anxiety-ridden time for everybody in America, including political scientists, because it's something that perhaps we should have been more open to. We just never thought would happen here, and we didn't study it, and we didn't try to analyze events that could happen here. We do that in other countries, but now we're having to look at ourselves and look at the discipline and investigate what are further things that could happen here.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University in the state of Georgia. President Trump remains defiant amid calls to resign and plans to spend his last days in office, quote, playing offense. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Trump's aides hope he spends his last days trying to trumpet his policy accomplishments, beginning with a trip to Alamo, Texas on Tuesday to highlight border wall construction and efforts to curb illegal immigration. An ABC News Ipsos poll released Sunday found that over half of Americans, 56%, believe that Trump should be removed from office before his term ends. And two-thirds of respondents, 67%, said he deserves blame for the rioting last week. I'm Julie Walker.
Washington, D.C. and U.S. government officials are pressing law enforcement authorities to safeguard President-elect Joe Biden's Washington inauguration. They want to prevent any further violence by supporters of President Trump who stormed the U.S. Capitol last week. Biden's inauguration committee said on Monday the theme of the January 20th ceremony will be America United, even as the country grapples with the fallout of the assault on Congress by Trump's followers. In a letter to Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, who resigned on Monday, Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser called for a fresh approach to security after what she called last week's unprecedented terrorist attack. Bowser submitted a request for a pre-disaster declaration, and that request has been granted. The U.S. National Guard says it has also authorized up to 15,000 Guard members to meet current and future inauguration support requirements. Multiple news organizations report that an FBI bulletin says armed protests are being planned at all 50 state capitals between January 16th through the 20th, as well as at the U.S. Capitol from January 17th through the 20th. The full extent of the assault on the U.S. Capitol is also becoming more clear, with scenes of violence so vast they are difficult to grasp. Countless smartphone videos have been emerging from the scene, and more lawmakers are recounting the chaos that was around them. Although they reveal the threatening nature of the assault and they point to the crowd as a force determined to occupy the inner sanctums of Congress and hunt down its leaders, Vice President Mike Pence and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi among them. Democratic Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts says what he witnessed was a display of homegrown fascism that was out of control. The FBI is investigating whether some of the attackers intended to kidnap members of Congress and hold them hostage. Authorities are particularly focused on why some of the mob were seen carrying plastic zip-tie handcuffs and had apparently accessed areas of the Capitol generally difficult for the public to locate. Far-right social media users had openly hinted for weeks that chaos would erupt at the Capitol when Congress convened to certify the election results. As the attack unfolded, they urged followers to trust the plan and hold the line. Just what the plan may have been is central to the investigation. The United States on Monday imposed sanctions on several Ukrainian individuals and entities over U.S. election interference. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden is following that story and has this update.
The new sanctions announced today by the Department of Treasury in the U.S. targeting seven individuals, four entities, and all of them are said to be part of this Russian-linked foreign influence network associated with a Ukrainian member of parliament, Andrei Durkach. Durkach first was talked about publicly by the U.S. intelligence community back in September of 2020, months before the election, and when the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, Bill Evanina, singled him out in a warning about election interference, saying that Durkach was spreading claims about corruption in an effort to help Russia undermine the candidacy of now President-elect Joe Biden. So his name was put out then. He was sanctioned, around September. And then now Treasury is going after some of his associates, including former Ukrainian government officials, one current member of parliament, and four companies that form his disinformation operation.
Has any information been released as to the timing of these sanctions? Because, you know, leading up to the 2020 election, there had been a lot of information put out there by the intelligence community about election interference. So what can you tell us about the timing of things?
Well, one of the things that President Trump actually signed back in 2018 was an executive order designed to take aim at any foreign entity, any foreign country trying to interfere and trying to meddle with U.S. elections. And so he signed this executive order. And as part of it, it allowed for sanctions to be levied against anybody who the U.S. concluded had tried to meddle. Specifically, it said 45 days after the election, the intelligence community needed to submit a report saying on basically summarizing what they saw in determining whether anyone actually did try to meddle with the election. That report was due this past December, December 18th. It was not handed in on time. It's a report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. It was just submitted to Congress last week and presumably to the other entities that needed to review this, including the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Attorney General. Now, the sanctions are coming under this executive order. It's unclear, though, whether the timing has anything to do with the submission of that report. Now, remember, even before the election took place, even before U.S. voters went to the polls, the intelligence officials came out, including the director of national intelligence, including the director of the FBI, and said they had seen two cases where both Iran and Russia had been trying to steal voter registration information and used it, in Iran's case, to send fake emails to voters trying to intimidate them before they went to the polls. So it's likely that the U.S. intelligence community concluded that Russia and Iran meddled with the elections. We also know repeatedly from comments from the director of national intelligence that he and others believe China also sought to meddle with the elections. But whether or not there will be more sanctions in the coming days, either against entities related to Russia or against Iran or China, remains to be seen.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. And coming up later,
we need to vaccinate more and more and more people and as fast as we can. For those countries that don't have the vaccine, it's important that there is a push from the international community to bring those vaccines in as fast as possible. While this happens, though, and we cannot wait for the silver bullet to arrive, and we need to take the precautions that can save lives.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. NASA announced that it is extending two of its current missions that are providing valuable new insight into our solar system. One of the missions to get the okay to continue its work is Juno, which has been sending back data that provides scientists with a better understanding of the origin and evolution of Jupiter. Juno began its mission after arriving at the giant planet in July 2016 and was scheduled to end its work this July. Its mission has now been extended to September 2025, or until the space probe stops working before then. The other mission is InSight, which has been studying the inner workings of Mars since it landed in November 2018. Its job on the Red Planet was to have ended a couple of months ago, but the space agency has tacked on an extra two more years to finish its work. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Saudi Arabia and its allies are welcoming a move by current U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to begin placing Yemen's pro-Iranian Houthis on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Iran's foreign ministry has condemned the decision, and Edward Uranian brings us the story.
Saudi-owned media applauded the announcement by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that he will ask Congress to place Yemen's Houthi militia group, which controls the capital Sana'a, on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The decision follows last month's Houthi drone attack on Aden Airport, controlled by the rival Yemeni government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi. Pompeo indicated in a tweet that the action was intended to confront the Houthis' terrorist activity and deter further malign activity by the Iranian regime in the region. Iran and its Lebanese Hezbollah proxy militia reportedly arm and train the Houthis. Ahmed bin Mubarak, foreign minister of the Saudi-backed Yemeni government, told Arab media that the U.S. decision was made to punish the Houthis for various terrorist acts, including the recent attack on Aden Airport, which killed and wounded dozens, attacks on Red Sea shipping, and Houthi missile attacks on Saudi Arabia. Houthi spokesman Mohammed al-Bukhaiti told Arab media that the U.S. decision was destined to fail and would make negotiations more difficult, in addition to making the Houthi group stronger. Saudi analyst Majid al-Turki told Qatar's Al Jazeera TV that he did not think the move would make negotiations more difficult, saying Kuwait tried for months to conduct negotiations between rival Yemeni forces and was unable to broker a deal. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said in a press conference Monday that the decision marked, in his words, the bankruptcy of the outgoing Trump administration. The Yemen conflict, he added, must come to the negotiating table sooner or later. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that there is a political dimension to the U.S. move, since the Trump administration would like to make the Houthis sit down at the negotiating table and accept a U.N.-brokered settlement of the Yemen conflict. Iran-based analyst Imad Abshans told Arab media that the administration only has 9 days left and then everything is going to change. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the National Defense University in Washington, however, thinks that revoking a terrorism designation is not simple and that with everything that is going on in Washington, this is going to take the back burner. He said a lot of people in Washington find Iran a threat to the U.S. and that the Houthis are seen as an ally of Iran. He said it doesn't seem likely that things are going to improve for them, even under the Biden administration. Joe Biden will be inaugurated as the 46th president of the United States on January 20th. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Trump administration has also redesignated Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism in a move that hits the country with new sanctions shortly before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the step on Monday, and he cited in particular Cuba's continued harboring of U.S. fugitives, as well as its support for Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Removing Cuba from the blacklist had been one of former President Barack Obama's main foreign policy achievements, as he sought better relations with the communist-led island. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, a staunch supporter of Obama's rapprochement, condemned Pompeo for what he calls a blatantly politicized designation, saying domestic terrorism in the United States poses a far greater threat to Americans. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies warns COVID-19 vaccines should not lull people into a false sense of complacency. It says vaccines alone will not end the pandemic. People must remain vigilant and continue to practice public health measures. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
COVID-19 vaccines are being rolled out in a number of countries around the world, giving rise to hopes that the pandemic will soon come to an end. The International Red Cross Federation's Director of Health, Emmanuel Capobianco, views vaccines as an important tool to stop this dreaded disease in its tracks. He tells VOA immunization drives are a matter of life and death, and that countries which have the vaccine must increase the speed and scale of inoculations.
We need to vaccinate more and more and more people and as fast as we can. For those countries that don't have the vaccine, it's important that there is a push from the international community to bring those vaccines in as fast as possible. While this happens, though, and we cannot wait for the silver bullet to arrive, and we need to take the precautions that can save lives.
He says these include basic preventive measures such as physical distancing, wearing masks, isolating when sick, and going into quarantine when coming in contact with an infected person. Capobianco says these actions are particularly important now as the epidemic is infecting and killing people at a rate not seen since the beginning of the crisis a year ago. He notes global cases are averaging 800,000 a day, including 15,000 deaths. He says these spikes appear in part to be driven by the emergence of two new COVID-19 variants in Britain and South Africa. He says the variants are more contagious than COVID-19 and more people are getting infected. Fortunately, he notes, the new strains do not appear to decrease the effectiveness of the vaccines. He says the new variants have now spread to more than 40 other countries, including in Africa.
That is something that will need to be watched very, very closely because somehow Africa has been affected less than many had predicted by this pandemic so far, and we would hope that Africa could still see lower numbers of cases and deaths, but the indication is that numbers are increasing.
Capobianco says everyone should look forward to being vaccinated against COVID in the near future. In the meantime, he urges people to remain vigilant and protect themselves. He warns the entire world remains at risk from this disease until all countries receive the vaccines in a fair and equitable manner. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There's a crisis in South Africa's competitive chess world that cuts to the core of the country's own struggles to build a fair society. VOA's Anita Powell has more.
Chess is taught as a game of skill and savage elegance, played out on a board where both sides are equal. But in South Africa, one of the world's most unequal societies, the business of chess is not that simple. For 3 years, the National Federation has been embroiled in expensive lawsuits that have thrown the sport into confusion and, Parliament argues, kept deserving players away. As a result, the government has suspended its funding, about $120,000 per year, until they break the impasse. Chess South Africa ranks 12-year-old Lulu Miaka at 52nd nationally in her age group. And while she doesn't know what's going on in the back ranks of the organization, she sees the effects every weekend when she goes to a tournament or plays online and sees only well-off players.
I would really like for them probably to make it cheaper so that the less fortunate kids can also play. But for me, I do play a lot, but I don't see the less fortunate kids, because they made it very expensive. just to join a tournament, which they can't go into.
That continuing inequality and how to address it seems to be the crux of the problem here. The National Federation has two dueling boards with two very different visions, both claiming to lead and taking their argument to court. Parliament called in the factions in November to account for themselves, leading them to agree to start arbitration. VOA wanted to fairly represent the two men who claimed the top spot. So we flipped a coin to decide who got to speak first and asked, what's the main problem?
Our focus should be on leveling the playing field, bring everybody on board, and remember for the children, this is also part of socialization and education. That's why it's very important. That's why transformation is actually very important.
The transformation narrative is abused to score political points and to create an emotional agenda. And it also has the side effect, and in my mind, one of the worst side effects that you can have is that it gets rid of competence.
The government appears to side with Mahamoule's call to level the playing field, but the international chess body, FIDE, has vowed neutrality. Tuli Miaka, a self-described chess mom, offered an elegant solution to both warring presidents.
I think the two guys should step down on my position, on my take for everything, so that we don't have fights. We're not here to fight, we're here to play.
Will they take that advice? South Africa is the continent's chess powerhouse, with the greatest number of top-rated players in Africa. Or will this power game end bitterly? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well. Be safe and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump has brokered yet another major agreement, this time between Morocco and Israel. It is the fourth such agreement in as many months. In the coming weeks, Israel and Morocco will resume full diplomatic relations. This agreement will also grant overflights and direct flights to and from Israel and will promote economic cooperation between Israeli and Moroccan companies. Through this historic step, Morocco is building on its long-standing bond with the Moroccan Jewish community living in Morocco and throughout the world, including in Israel. The agreement further enhances Israel's security while creating opportunities for the two countries to deepen their economic ties and improve the lives of their people. In 1777, Morocco was the first country to grant diplomatic recognition to the United States of America. That same year, Morocco opened its ports to the ships of the new American Republic, allowing the U.S. to engage in trade and commerce and supporting the fight for freedom. "Our friendship has endured," declared Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. "Together with Israel and Morocco, we are declaring to the world that we are focused on unlocking the potential of all our citizens to ensure the continued prosperity and security of our countries." President Trump has also recognized Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. The United States continues to believe only political negotiations are capable of resolving the issues between Morocco and the Polisario, a political-military organization striving to end Moroccan control of Western Sahara and win independence for that region. As Secretary Pompeo noted, "We believe those negotiations should occur within the framework of Morocco's autonomy plan." Morocco's laudable efforts to promote religious tolerance from its historical tradition of protecting its Jewish minority, the promoting of religious freedom in the Marrakesh Declaration, to the new agreement with Israel, sets an example to the region and throughout the world. Secretary Pompeo noted that there is a powerful verse in the scripture that reads, "A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." The United States, Israel, and Morocco have embraced peace, and the world is better off for it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.